Welcome back after a hiatus brought on by holidays and a long battle with congestion not compatible with podcasting and somewhat ongoing, I apologize, for throat clearings and so on. My podcasts here have two audiences, followers of the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture, of which I'm a fellow, and my readers at Like Mother, Like Daughter, and Happy Despite Them, my two blogs. Three audiences. My readers know that family and marriage are topics dear to my heart. Those interested in the mission of the center will remember that we have the mission to follow the lead of our patron, St. Thomas More, in maintaining a focus on public witness to the faith in our culture. And our call to address the crisis of our civilization, which has drifted from the Christian principles on which it was founded. And to revive it. Since the bedrock of Christendom, and indeed all human community from the beginning, is the family, elevated and sanctified in marriage, I want to examine how the Church has been forming those wishing to marry and how it proposes to form them under a new approach announced by the Vatican. I can promise you, dear listener, that no assumption will escape confrontation in this podcast. Welcome to the Home Truths Good Cheer Society. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Gospel of John, chapter 16, verse 33. For those who don't know me, I'm Lila Marie Lawler, Auntie Lila. I'm the self-appointed collective memory curator. I write about competence, learning some skills of homemaking, and why we should do all those things on my blog, Like Mother, Like Daughter, and in my books, including the Summa Domestica, Order and Wonder in Family Life, which is a 3-volume box set, available at Sophia Institute Press. I'm all about the restoration of home in brightness, warmth, and joy. Today, I am welcoming Layla Miller to go into all of this with me. We are the two Laylas. I'm Lila, but as a fellow Arab, I also answer to Layla, but we will call each other by our usual pronunciations so that you have a chance of keeping us straight in this audio presentation, who channel our Mediterranean energy to challenging certain attacks on our faith, some of them coming from within, alas. Hello, Layla. Good to have you over here.
Hi, Lila. I'm so excited to finally do a To Layla or To Lila podcast.
Yes, we are. We have been talking about this for a long time, and we just weren't exactly sure how to get it going technologically and otherwise. But this is our inauguration, and we are going to really get into the battle, jumping in with 4 feet.
Yes, I can't wait.
Layla Miller has done an amazing thing. She has single-handedly caused an examination of conscience regarding the way the Church looks at divorce in our time, both socially and as a matter of canon law. This examination is ongoing. There is no question that her work and her writings, which I will link to in the show notes, has changed the conversation about divorce and annulment. You can tell by how, on the one hand, how angry some people become, and on the other, how relieved and grateful others are. At the end of our examination here of marriage prep, we will talk about what Layla calls the two greased exit ramps from marriage. So be sure to listen to that point. This is going to be, I think, I'm predicting, a long podcast, but we got to get it done. There are so many things to go into in this topic. Both the current methods of marriage prep and the new suggestions quote unquote suggestions, guidelines that surely will be implemented strike me and my guests as not only problematic, but flawed in their conception, assumptions, and goals. We each separately posted about the new guidelines on Facebook more than 6 months apart. I posted in the summer and she posted recently because these new Vatican guidelines came out last summer, actually. Layla's post had almost 300 comments. Mine had almost 400 comments. So I think we should go through the issues systematically here. In everything we say, please, we beg you, take it as read that we believe that most people involved in these programs to prepare people for marriage have good intentions, and we are not questioning that. Some at the highest levels do not have good intentions, which is why Scripture warns, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." We do have to be wise. We do have to examine these issues, but we are not attacking you, hard worker, to prepare those who wish to get married, nor are we attacking you, engaged couples, doing your best to obey and fulfill requirements. We are trying to recover some sanity as to ways and means, goals and principles. Layla, you have children who are married, who recently got married just as I do. We're basically the same age. We each have 7 children who are all grown, almost all grown. I think a couple of yours are a bit younger. Can you jump in here and just help me describe how things are going now, what the current practice is now?
Sure. And I want to add, I do have 8 children because I don't want to leave that last one out. So it, in my diocese now, and I do want to say up front, I was for about 2 years, my husband and I were part of marriage prep in this diocese. We went through the training. We had engaged couples in our home for focus, but we went through the big training too, when everything went to like a different system. It's a 9-month program here in my Diocese of Phoenix. So essentially, if I recall correctly, there are different components. We always have a full course of NFP requirement here in this diocese. Again, it's a 9-month from start to finish. I don't know that there's a whole lot of flexibility with that. There is the focus, which the compatibility type test that the couple takes and then later meets with facilitators to go over that. There are retreats. I think it's God's Plan for a Joy-Filled Marriage is the one that is used here, I believe, and that's a weekend retreat. The teams are wonderful. The ones that I have worked with, good people. And I'm not sure about the other components. There might be a couple other things that need to happen, but it's a process of meeting with certain people in certain groups and then doing retreats over the course of
and that does vary somewhat diocese to diocese. So it's, I think the guidelines from the USCCB are 6 months. I think some dioceses do now say a year. And there's one component that's often referred to as pre-Cana, and we'll refer to it sometimes in our discussion as that. And that can consist of different, such as you've described, and it could be other things as well. One part that is actually part of the marriage process and has to be part is the canonical screening, which is a form that you fill out and the priest goes over with the engaged couple, which determines their ability to get married, that they're free to marry, that no one has coerced them into marriage, that they are not, don't have consanguinity. They're not sister and brother or cousins, first cousins. And so on, that they have not been married before.
Right. Or taken another vow, a different vow. And whether they're psychologically healthy, and people have to vouch for that, that they are psychologically healthy, and they sign all that.
So that's historical screening. So, for instance, funny note, my husband and I, when we were engaged, actually did have to get a dispensation from the bishop to marry because my husband previously had stood for me when I was baptized. So he, in effect, I mean, I was 18 when I was baptized, 17. So I was not a baby. I was not an infant, but he was essentially my godfather. And that is a relationship. And so the bishop has to dispense the requirement that you not have that relationship. And you can see why that would be necessary, because you can't be coerced in any way. Christianity has bestowed this amazing gift to humanity, which is the idea that the man and the woman should be free to marry, and especially the woman cannot be coerced in any way. So that is how it stands now. And what is being proposed by this new Vatican instruction is to expand this preparation to a year. And keep in mind that this is a year after the decision has been arrived at to be engaged. You're dating and you present yourselves, you know, you've been dating for 3 weeks and then you go talk to the priest and he says, yeah, well, let's set up a year long process. It is from the point that the couple are engaged. And this came down from the Vatican, and I'm just going to give a couple of quotes that crystallize, you know, it is in some ways, it's going to be the same sort of thing that's been going on, but in other ways, it will be different. And I think these couple of quotes will summarize what the difference is. So the aim is to set up, and this is a quote, discernment paths of catechumenal inspiration, which can truly accompany young people to rediscover their faith and experience it when the vocation to family life opens up in them. And then a quote from the article that was in the Our Sunday Visitor says, the new document lays out three main stages for the new marriage catechumenate, which are proximate preparation, about a year, including a rite of betrothal, final preparation, a few months, including a retreat, and accompaniment, the last phase stretches into the first years of marriage. The catechumenate is to be preceded by remote preparation, age-appropriate formation in youth programs, etc., and an intermediate phase lasting a few weeks during which a ritual entry into the catechumenate proper occurs. So we could actually spend an hour unpacking this language.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fraught with a lot of vagueness and somewhat inspirational words that don't really have a ton of content.
Yeah, I chafe when I see anything like this kind of language that could mean anything and kind of often doesn't mean anything, because since I've started my work on divorce, you know, the evils of divorce, the effects of divorce, what's gone wrong just in marriage in general now in America, Western world, and also the annulment issues. I keep telling people the fix is not in the marriage prep. So this is all very interesting to me, because it appears that the focus is all on marriage prep. It's like, how can we fix it? How can we make it better? How can marriage prep in marriage prep will somehow save marriage? And I have never, ever thought that, because it clearly is, from my work, from what I see, it's not going to help. Marriage prep situations aren't going to, you know, you can change it all you want, but we can get into that a little bit later. But yeah, so.
Yes, we will definitely get into that later. And I think it's interesting that we're starting right away with terms such as a vocation to family life, which could be interpreted as meaning vocation to marriage. But those are not the words. The word is not marriage that's being used here. But marriage is the state that the couple are proposing to enter into. And there's even a question of whether that's a vocation. And maybe we'll be able to get into that later. because the problems that I see with this whole catechumena way and this process, which of course morphs into programs, is that, to be very clear and just to put things into the traditional context, let us just state that marriage is the natural state of man and woman given by God in the Garden of Eden as a covenant that he made that they would be a gift to each other in matrimony.
Yes. And I say this a lot to people, that God, in his created order, expected that the vast, vast, vast majority of human adults would marry. That is the, like you said, is the natural state of things for most people who reach the age of, you know, procreation or adulthood. And so it can't be compared, for example, to, you know, holy orders, a priesthood, religious life, where this is something a little extraordinary. You know, this is, it's taken out of the norm, out of the natural, into more the, you know, especially ordination, into the supernatural, that pretty much every human being on the planet, you know, who comes of age has that ability and the natural right to marry, and is expected to go that route. That's the natural way that people do live out their adulthood, you know, their lives. So,
and it's really embedded in our physical natures as man and woman, and the whole theology of the body that has been the paradigmatic way since the time of John Paul II to look at, I mean, almost everything. The proponents of it really do say this is the lens with which we can look at every single thing. Our theology can be ordered and organized by the theology of the body. Well, I really challenge the proponents of that theology, which I have read very deeply into and do affirm as it is propounded by John Paul II, to see that this means precisely that it is embedded in our physical and spiritual and ontological natures as man and woman to, you know, he calls it the nuptial meaning of the body, and it is for marriage, and it is something that that man and woman have the right to do if they're free to do it, to enter into this state. And in canon law, that is affirmed, that people have, a man and a woman who are free to marry have the right to marry.
Yes.
So this is, when we talk about this, this really, I feel like this really just, it's something that is not talked about. It, and I think that stating it that way is important for going forward to say, well, now when we talk about marriage preparation, we always need to be holding it up to that basic principle and fact that we are made to marry and that we have a right to marry if we are free to marry.
And those are foundational principles and understandings. And it's something that, you know, again, I was raised Catholic from the cradle, and those types of terms or that understanding, it was never told to me. And this is extremely simple. I always go back to, the faith is not brain surgery. This is simple stuff. It needs to be taught foundationally. It needs to be taught easily. It can be taught. It can be taught to children. It can be taught to, you know, teenagers. It can be taught to adults that have never heard it. And it instantly resonates and people understand what you're talking about. It's not that difficult. So we need to kind of get back to that. And so when I read certain things like what the church is now proposing, or some people in the church are proposing, it's so complicated and strangely bureaucratic. First, let us get to the basics and talk about what marriage is, and that it is a natural state, and that it is a right, a natural right for anyone who is free to marry.
And when we think about it that way, I mean, I have said for a long time, I mean, my husband and I have been married for more than 43 years now. Our marriage formation was deplorable. And I do not think that marriage preparation, broadly speaking today, is in good shape. I think that adding another layer to it, and we'll get into some of the particulars of that in a bit, you know, because I think sometimes people do tend to forget the experiences that they have and the things that they've heard. And they're just like, well, no, it's good. It's nice. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Our parish is wonderful. Our diocese is wonderful. But actually, I think we need to have, you know, bring to the fore certain examples, and we will get to that. But I just want to say right now that adding another layer to what we already have going on, particularly in this proposal, which the layer that I'm talking about is not just, it is somewhat more of the same, but it also is very different in this idea of adding rituals that don't seem to me to be organically developed. There is a rite of
betrothal. Is that the
betrothal in the traditional church? But something tells me that that's not what they're gonna do. There's particularly in confirmation, there are rites that have been added to the confirmation process, and they strike me as having this very made up quality, a very like made by committee quality that feels awkward and has a make do, a sort of make work aspect to it. Like, oh, we have all these people engaged in this, you know, one or two year long process. We need things for them to do that kind of feel quasi religious. And I feel that adding this layer of ritual, of some form of like quasi liturgical accompaniment, just doesn't address the problems that we have going on right now of how inadequate marriage preparation is. And the reason that I call it inadequate, and I think you've said the same thing, is that it completely ignores what basic Christian formation is, which again, as you have said, is so simple. The Ten Commandments, the precepts of the church, one of which involves marriage, has to do with observing the laws of marriage, especially its indissolubility. Formation in understanding the idea of what a sacrament is and this particular seven sacraments, the creed, all of which form the basic catechesis that has always gone on since the church was founded. Again, very simple, can be all carried around in a small pamphlet called the Penny Catechism, which does not take long to go through and even discuss. But in all of that, in the context, it's not dry intellectual knowledge. It's not studying in workbooks. It's in the context of family life.
Right, which is where the formation is supposed to begin and continue. I agree with your thoughts that what we're bringing in, you know, more and more layers, it smacks of busy work. You know, those of us who have, I homeschooled a little bit, and then, you know, and have been in, my kids have been in different types of schools, and you always know when something is busy work rather than actually contributing to something good. And I just think that when you add these layers of, again, like you said, there are, and again, we cannot stress this enough. The good intentions of everyone involved. I get it, especially on the lower layers. You know, I don't know about the higher ups, and I don't know who's not of good intent, but the people that I know, you know, that's what they go to school for. It's what they prepare their careers for, work in the church. So I get it. It's a very loving, selfless way to live, but it almost does become, okay, we need to give these people something to do. We need to give them jobs, information somehow, rather than kind of looking back to, well, the simplicity of 2,000 years of people getting married in the church and entering into the sacrament of matrimony didn't have these professional layers and these different, you know, kind of maybe hoops to jump through and things like that. So it has not contributed to, and we can see that just empirically, I mean, it has not contributed to better marriages, better married life, better families, and hasn't contributed to keeping people married either. So this marriage prep that keeps growing and has layers, and like you said, where's the basic formation? My sister and I used to joke about our marriage prep back in the 90s. And this was before my reversion and before her really a deeper understanding of the faith. But even then, we just knew what we had just gone through. I did it. Our marriage prep was in Georgia and hers was in California. It was a joke. I mean, we would laugh about it, about how foolish it was. And it was just, wasting time, really. And we made fun of the people. And again, I was young, we make fun of people, but it was goofy. And so, it's kind of lore. I always say it's kind of lore. Everybody kind of says that. Most people don't say they had a good marriage prep experience. Some people do. Some people do say it. But if we really, it's like my whole generation that didn't have good catechesis. We all know it. The ones that have come and self-taught ourselves, we all know that it was a joke. The CCD classes, for example, but same with marriage prep. So we get it. It's a cultural experience that we've all had. I wish we could face it and say, it was really bad. And just adding more layers, like you say, is not going to fix, it's lipstick on a pig. It's not going to fix this. So I like what you said about just basic Catholic formation, just the Ten Commandments and the principles that we haven't heard, and then living in family life and the simplicity of things, which doesn't make things easy, but things are simple.
Right. And I don't even mean those things should be brought up, as review, or for some people they are going to be news, the Ten Commandments, etc. But I even mean talking about the Ten Commandments in parish life. You brought up CCD, religious education, that children be taught and asked to memorize the Ten Commandments. We're always complaining about and lamenting the fact that children don't know anything about their faith. I really question whether you take the priest on the street, whether you take the bishop on the street, and you hold up a microphone and is up to him and say, do you know what the Ten Commandments are? Could you recite them? I question if they could. I question whether, if we look through all the materials that are produced and given to children throughout all their years of religious education, if we could really sift out that the Ten Commandments had been presented and had been discussed, if parents had been really urged and admonished to teach, to learn the Ten Commandments and teach them to their children, because this is where it all really happens. It's really in the home that the mother and the father would be saying little by little over the years to their children, so do you know what the commandments are? Do you realize that when you told that lie, you were breaking the eighth commandment? Do you understand that when you took that piece of gum from your sister's drawer that you were stealing, that you were breaking a commandment? And all the things that, back in the past were gone over in the Baltimore Catechism, were addressed from the pulpit, were brought up in conversations, they just simply are not. And instead, we've substituted a lot of apologetics, a lot of argumentation, a lot of really quite intricate, and then sometimes goofy and silly theological or quasi-theological arguments. And we really have abandoned the basic and really loving sorts of preparation that we really need. Now, bringing up the sixth commandment and marriage prep, I really wonder whether in all these months of preparation now proposed to extend to a year, whether the sixth commandment will be squarely addressed, that it relates to such ills as cohabitation and premarital sex. I have to throw out a little anecdote about, I sing in a choir, and our choir was invited to provide the music for a confirmation at which the Archbishop, then Archbishop, was going to be presiding. And so I had a pretty good front row seat of what happened in that in that ceremony. And it was very interesting to me that in his homily, His Excellency spoke a lot about, he actually did bring up cohabitation, and he talked about it pretty extensively. And he said, when I was a child, divorce was unheard of. And he went on to talk about, most of you will be called to the vocation of marriage, and I just want to talk about cohabitation. And he went on to talk about it in I would say, exclusively social science terms, the facts and figures and the percentages of people who cohabit and the likelihood that those people would not marry the person they were cohabiting with, and if they did marry the person, that they would end up divorcing, et cetera, et cetera. It was from a completely secular social science point of view, and never at any point did he say, it is a sin against the sixth commandment to live with a person as if that person is your spouse. And at that moment, the iron really entered my soul about what the role of this authority, because an archbishop is an authority, what his role is. And his role, leave the social science to the social scientists. Any person cohabiting, or any young, like 16-year-old, I think that all the confirmandees were probably around 16, hearing all these facts and figures would pretty much, the natural response is to say, oh, 65% of people get divorced. Well, that won't be me.
Right.
Whereas if the authority says, this is a sin, you cannot do it, that strikes your conscience.
Right. That sin is never permitted. That sin offends God. That sin harms the body of Christ. Sin harms all the people around you, your community, your family. It harms, you know, it harms your soul. You may, you know, if you do it willfully, you could end up in hell. Why aren't we teaching those things? You're right. It's not a statistic. It's a truth from the very word of God, the very created order of God, that if we offend God, things go very wrong for us and for those around us. It's not taught that way. You're right. And that is, I think, because the sensibilities of our prelates are like the rest of us, you know, in society, not to offend anyone, not to make them feel judged, or, you know, if you just present them facts and figures and, you know, you think you're persuading, but again, like you said, it doesn't prick the conscience, but their conscience, you know, have not been formed perhaps. Well, maybe it's time to form them. It's never too late. So, but that is interesting that he took that route. That would not be the thing that would persuade people. People forget that humans, you know, we are hardwired to hear the truth, and we're hardwired to want and accept the truth. It resonates in the soul, even dimly, you know, but people do want it. And so, how beautiful when someone can just say the simple truth. I mean, you've done it with people. I've done it with people a whole lot of times. It's people of goodwill. People of goodwill, and a lot of those kids are, I'm certain, of goodwill, and they want to know the truth. They will hear it. They will be okay with it. You know, he needn't fear. I feel like maybe he feared being seen as mean or judgmental.
Yeah. I think that our clergy have been convinced that they need to convince and persuade. And I think that something else that has really struck me is that if you or I say, look, that would be a sin against the sixth commandment, we're trying to inform a conscience. So conscience needs to be informed, which is, I'm informing you that these are God's commandments. They are givens. Not everybody has necessarily heard of the Ten Commandments, although the natural law, which they do embody, is in our hearts. But that's where you just have to be informed. The people in authority, so parents, have to say, I want to teach you God's law, and then teach it very clearly. So here's the crux of it. If you or I say to a person who is not under our authority, say a class of confirmandi, or we're helping in marriage prep. So we're talking to another couple. So we are on the same level as they are in terms of authority. And if we say, you need to realize that when you have sex outside of marriage, that offends against a commandment of God, they do not hear that in the main, in general. I mean, some people will react in their consciences, but if there's a problem there, if they are struggling with this, they will not hear it as a word of authority, because we're not actually in authority to them. We can persuade and give arguments, but one thing about arguments is that arguments incite in the person counter arguments. Whereas when a person in authority, which would be the priest and especially the bishop, says, if he forgoes persuasion and simply says, I in authority am now telling you what God's commandments are, and that this would be an offense against God's commandment, the person might not be persuaded, but that's not really the point. The point is that they hear it, because just hearing it strikes their conscience, and they may react with a push against, and they may seem to be disgruntled, and they may say that you are mean, and they may kick against the goad, but it will strike their conscience. And they may even leave, but they will never forget that their conscience, that bell had been rung. And that's what's missing. So I feel like it's, you know, the formation starts in the family, and the family isn't just a nice institution that kind of helps out with community life. It's the foundation of life here on earth, and one of the three fundamental societies, which are church, state, or community, and family. And it shares, the family, unlike the state, shares in a sacramental relationship in the Eucharist with the mission of the church. And so when the parents are trying to form the children, the parents desperately need for the clergy to also be providing that formation and also to be using their authority. And this is how we would raise children to be ready to be married. However, what we find today is that the clergy are actually actively undermining family life. And the ways that they do that are by implicitly or explicitly supporting feminism, which is contrary to marriage. And we can see that very clearly, because feminists try to destroy marriage at every opportunity. And the stated goals of feminists who articulate feminism insofar as it can be articulated are to destroy this covenantal relationship between man and woman, which is essentially hierarchical. It is a covenant of equals, but it is a hierarchical covenant. And the clergy fall into that, in that they do not present marriage as matrimony, which is the making of a mother. And they fail to oppose divorce and contraception. And divorce, I want to leave until the end, but I think it is very clear that our clergy do not, in practice, oppose contraception. And they certainly don't take the daring step of opposing it vocally. And we just know this because 95% of Catholic couples contracept. So I think it's just a given. And that really is, I think we just need to confront that. And whether people feel that they're well-intentioned or not, I feel that we need to confront the fact that when it comes to these fundamental principles of life, I just don't see that our clergy are actively supporting us.
Right. I have, thankfully, I have wonderful priests. in my diocese, and I live in a little bit of a bubble, a Novus Ordo bubble, but it's a good one. But I occasionally do go venture out to California or to other places, and you know, it's always back to a shock to the system. It's very worldly. There's just the same worldly sentiments that we all are swimming in out here in the world. The clergy are swimming in them as well. The clergy were raised as feminists, raised to believe that divorce is just part of, you know, unfortunately part of life, you know, things fall apart. And of course, contraception is just absolutely a given. That is a third rail topic. Nobody, you know, they don't really want to touch that, perhaps because they don't truly believe it. I don't know. But that is going to undermine every part of matrimony. Absolutely. The sacrament of matrimony, I think we've talked about, you know, that's, it's not really preached. It's not really talked about as a sacrament. It's not. I don't remember it being talked about. I know we'll save divorce for later, but I mean, even just that, like the first time I heard an anti-divorce sermon was when I was 50 years old. And that's when I had just started writing about it, but I almost fell off my pew. So there's something very worldly going on from the pulpit. I mean, it's the only time people are really there to hear what the church has to say. Let's face it. Most Catholics who even still come to church, that's where you have the captive audience. And when those things aren't being taught correctly, and again, simply, there's not a, it's not, I go back to, you know, maybe people think, oh, it's so complicated. We don't know how to say it to the people. It's really not that complicated. It's really back to just basic God's created order and what is the nature of a thing and what did God want for us and for family? It's not that complicated. It's just scary. I think it's scary for people, for priests to talk about because they don't know what the reaction will be. And for the ones who do believe deeply in it, I'm sure they're afraid of the backlash and the, you know, the complainers, and there's plenty of those, but they have to be fearless. It's simple, and they will have, I just want to say encouragement to some priests listening that you will have more people probably thanking you than you can imagine. You know, try it. It's very scary, but try it.
Yeah. I mean, even in the bubbles, I think that it's very rare. First of all, we can just look around and we can just see that people do not have very large families, that it's remarkable if there are large families. And I don't think that there are very many priests who, and just speaking generally, but even in like the good parishes, quote unquote, I don't think that there are many priests who would say to the engaged couple, to the wife, are you planning to work when you have children? Do you realize how burdensome that would be and how it is not possible? And this is actually a teaching of the church from antiquity, but particularly in our age when, because after the Industrial Revolution and then the Feminist Revolution, which started way before people realize the teaching is that women being drawn outside of the home, speaking generally of not like that you can't go outside of your house, but being drawn to commitments outside of the home, being answerable and earning a wage, that is detrimental to family life. And this was something articulated by Pius XI in Casti Canubi, and he really predicted and prophetically laid down that women would become wage slaves, which is exactly what we have. I never hear a priest from the pulpit or a bishop saying that men and women have to be willing to accept less, to accept a life that is perhaps not as prosperous as society says that we should have, in order to preserve the not only the integrity of the home and the well-being of the children, but to prevent the wife from being what Pius XI calls a wage slave. And we, this is an objection when I bring any of this up. This is the objection that proves what it is that I'm saying, because people will say, oh, you just don't understand that women have to work. Well, if women have to work, then that means that women are, in fact, wage slaves. And this is something that has to be confronted. And I think that even in, you know, even in quote unquote good places, this is just simply never brought up. And I feel that a young couple is left kind of thrown to the wolves because they think they're just going to go along with the worldly thing of, sure, he'll work and I'll work and that'll be great. And they don't think about what will come up when they realize, oh, we do want to have a lot of children, but we've chosen this way of life that requires two incomes. I mean, just from a very practical point of view, they just really don't. I know so many women who have said, nobody warned me. Nobody told me that this would create conflict, that I would be super stressed out, that my children would be crying when I left the house. Nobody said anything to me. This is the role of the authority of the clergy. It's also the role of the older, more mature couples. And I have to be honest, and I don't see that people really are offering that wisdom. And in fact, they just, as you say, they just go along with the worldly plan. I'm a huge thing that just stands starkly in the room like an elephant is that marriage, even just looked at philosophically, not even, you know, in terms of revelation or from a religious point of view, marriage is primarily ordered to procreation. It is ordered to the having of children. The reason to marry is to have children. And of course, the husband and the wife love each other. The man and the woman meet each other. They fall in love. They love each other. They want to be united. And that unity, and again, we're talking, I can say all of this in theology of the body terms. This is precisely what John Paul taught, is that the unity of the two produces this gift, which is the child. The child. It's not an abstraction. It's not their abstract love. It is the child, a human person, another human person, co-created with God. And even in the case of those who sadly are not able to have physical children, that gift that's embedded in their hearts still does tend towards this idea that marriage is primarily ordered to procreation. Even in their longing for it, we see the evidence of it. But I really believe from the evidence that our clergy do not actually really believe this, and the people have not been affirmed in this. And so we have this terrible lack and blank in the whole marriage prep idea, where it's not even mentioned. It's not even brought up.
Right. So yeah, there would be no marriage and there would be no sex if it were not for the end of sex and marriage, which is children. Children is the reason, you know, the church still teaches, believe it or not, even though we've kind of whitewashed it and brushed it away and we pretend that it doesn't exist, but the church still to this day teaches that the primary end of marriage is the procreation and formation of children. The primary end. And we don't talk about it. It's like, okay, matrimony. Okay, great. You're getting married. Okay, how do you feel about each other? What are you going to act? How are you going to act towards one another? It's all about the adults, right? It's all about the two, which is wonderful. Of course, it's about the adults. But the primary purpose of this union, this one flesh union, is to procreate, to have children and raise them up. So where is that, right? We don't hear that it's primary. We don't hear. I bet most people out there did not hear that from the church growing up or from the pulpit. Did you know that, people that are listening to this? Did you know that the church teaches? And of course, nature shows us, but it's also just natural law. You know, this is what marriage is ordered toward. And like you said, even the infertile, every act is still ordered toward the procreation of children. That's the correct ordering. And that's how God made this. So, yeah, it doesn't come up. I've never heard, I honestly don't think I've ever heard that. So other than just through my own study, right? Because a lot of this is like self-study. People who come up with this and know what the church teaches, a lot of times it's like, well, I had to figure this out by going and looking at old documents, you know, or you know, between scripture and catechisms and canon law and all the different things that I've looked at. It's almost like it's a textual church. It's written, it's there, but you don't hear it. You don't hear it preached.
Oh yeah. So much in scripture. I mean, that's how it struck me, was reading the Bible and realizing, oh, children in the Bible are a blessing. Mm-hmm. Where did anybody ever say how wonderful it would be to have children, to just have children, let them come? Only the witness of other families who had internalized this helped me to realize, oh, this is actually what this is all about. So that's just a really, really big thing that needs to be the organizing principle, again, of what marriage prep should be, and which I do not find in either the marriage prep that we have today or this proposal. Now, getting back to the proposal, I think it's interesting that there are some people who think, because things are in such a dire state, oh, yes, it would be a really good idea to lengthen the time. And then they kind of double down and they go into this really odd, strange trope, which is that it's good for a man and a woman who have decided, presumably because they super duper love each other and would love to be united, that it is good for them and even a good test to make them wait. And that if they cannot wait, that is a sign that they're weak and bad.
I can't think of too much else that is as wrongheaded as that proposition. It's like, okay, so we're going to put them in temptation's way on purpose for a really long time, when all of nature is, you know, and our faith, and but especially at this point, you know, nature itself is calling them together. And they have a right to be together, you know, if they're free to marry. Why would you put a temptation? It's cruel. I mean, to me,
yeah,
it's cruel. Who does this? Like, oh, I mean, you're going to, I just, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, my husband had said to me, and I think he actually did leave a comment on your post. He said, hold on, it is not correct to say that the feeling that the man and the woman, the unmarried couple, feel towards each other is lust. You can make it into lust by making them wait right. for a really long time, an undue amount of time. But that attraction is not per se lust. And the desire to consummate is not a bad thing at all. And marriage, in fact, is a remedy for concupiscence, which somebody was challenging me about that, and I was kind of like, no, it is a remedy for concupiscence, but we don't assume that what the couple are feeling is concupiscence that is a bad thing. But it could turn into it, in which case the wise person, the wise clergyman would say, you know what, let's just go ahead. You are ready. You have a right to marry. Let's get you married. I feel like in all of this, do we detect an almost Manichaean revulsion for sex? There's something effete about it, like this distaste. Oh, well. And even, you know, that speaks to the aging of our population, the fact that, you know, the people providing all of these guidelines and then the people who are implementing them are just getting a little old and maybe have forgotten what it's like. And like how marvelous and wonderful it is to be in love, and how beautiful it is to look forward to the consummation, and how really unduly difficult it is to be made to wait. So I feel like we need a reality check there. Like maybe, buddy, you're just a little too old.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I think you're right on that. Because it's something instinctually just hits a person when they hear a year. Why would a young couple who's in love, who presumably, and again, you know, I wish we could take these things individually, you know, this couple who is devout or who's faithful or who knows their faith, and they've made a decision. Cause again, isn't, you know, what it's a decision that these two moral agents are free to make. They have a right to make it. Nature itself is calling them together. They want to be together. Like you said, there's a desire for consummation. This is to be celebrated. I mean, so the idea, like you said, it. Why is this lust? This is rightly ordered. This is rightly ordered, right. And it can be pure and beautiful, and that's why people come together in marriage. So, who would make it look almost tainted, you know, or talk about it in a way that almost taints it? Like, oh, you can't wait. Like, what's wrong with you that you know, you want this person? Well, what? Aren't we supposed to? That's kind of the point.
I know. I feel like asking that person how long they wait to have their cup of coffee right. In the morning, or how long they, like, oh, really? Well, like when there's a buffet, where are you in the line in the buffet? Like, I feel like, I don't think that people, you know, I think there's just, you know, then there's also, I mean, the truth is that when people contracept after a while, they do kind of lose their libido. And that's the other thing about older people. I mean, and I wonder where all these couples who are going to be helping in this marriage formation, where we're going to find them, because, yes, many people are very good and very, you know, have good intention and everything. But if we step back and we just look at the current makeup of our church, I think that we have to be honest and say that the formators are very likely themselves to be contracepting. Some of them have been divorced. I just don't know where we're finding all these people to quote unquote form the faith. Your faith does not need to be that super well formed for you to get married. Raising your children will form your faith for you. You need to know the basics, and those basics do not take long. As I said, you can hand someone a penny catechism and it does not take long to go through it. It's a matter of a week or two. And the real goal of doing that is for them to have their conscience be awakened so that they can, you know, address moral issues and be headed towards this state with goodwill and you know, a clean conscience. And I think, like, let's just go through a little bit about, I know I can hear people saying, oh, but, you know, you don't realize like how good the program is and how important it is. And come on, you know, let's just say that it would be really, really good. And using this language of, you know, truly prepare them and good people, blah, blah, blah. And I just want to go over some real life examples that had real firsthand reporting that had come up in some of the comments. I'm just going to throw a couple of these out there just so we can have a little reality check. One person said, and by the way, each of these comments got dozens of thumbs ups. So this is not just one random person. These are things that you, Layla, and I have heard over and over again, and we know from our own children who have married and even from our friends that these things are endemic. So one was, the woman said, in my Catholic quote unquote Catholic marriage prep, couples were encouraged to abstain from sex for the final 2 weeks leading up to marriage if they could. And this person said, I did leave my name, number, address in emails and on a pager on my review and his email. Oh, this was a man actually. His emails, addresses, and a pager number in when asked to review the course, but strangely never heard back. Another person said, in our marriage prep, the instructors were talking about the beauty of living together after marriage and said, oh, if you are currently living with your fiancé, you know that that's a wonderful feeling, but it will be even better after the wedding. Oh, and I really have to question the retreat idea. I really, really have to question that. I think it is a really good thing to encourage each person So the man to go on a men's retreat and the woman to go on a women's retreat. I think a couple's retreat is not a good idea. I think it adds a lot of stress. But this one person commented that in an overnight engaged encounter retreat, that retreat gave couples the option of staying in the same bedroom. One person commented, at my daughter's pre-cana prep, most of the attendees were people who already had two children and been living together for a long time. One of the coordinators of the program commented in passing that she wished she had lived with her husband before they got married. So the question also becomes, where in the world are they going to find all these people to run these year-long programs? So, you know, again, just checking in with the document, let's just check in and see what it, remind ourselves what it said. The preparation should include encouraging couples to observe premarital chastity, in quotes, so that rather than, quote, becoming fixed on the physical instrumentalization of the other, they focus on dialogue and getting to know each other better.
Right. So going back to what we said earlier, so even biblically, we have these beautiful descriptions of young love, of longing to be together, and that's in the Bible. And so now the attraction of this couple is described as the physical instrumentalization of the other. I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh, but that's silly. That is silly. That is, I don't know who talks like that, first of all. Why would the church place that type of characterization upon something so purely natural and beautiful as a young couple who wants to be together in marriage? Unless they're already so jaded. Like, I guess there's some real, this just seems very jaded that, I mean, if that really is in quotes, premarital chastity, so that rather than becoming fixated on, okay, they focus on dialogue and getting to know each other better. I mean, again, I guess the presumption is, well, we know you guys are all, you know, you're already shacking up and sleeping together and stop thinking about how you want to be together, but let's just focus on getting to know each other. Well, what? Marriage is unique in all relationships in that it is the sexual one. It is the only place where sex is in context, you know, is good. Right. And getting to know each other comes after marriage. Like, right? You can certainly find out if you're compatible beforehand, and you need to figure out a few logistics of life and how you want to parent, or what you, okay, we'll talk finances.
That if you want to have children, yeah. I mean, there you go. There's a question that the priest needs to ask.
Yes.
You both realize that this is about having children. From the day you get married, you need to be ready to have
Thank
children.
Thank you.
If you're not ready to have children, you are not ready.
Exactly. And I've told people this, and even really good couples have not been catechized well, have not understood that this is the purpose of marriage. So that if you are someone who's a devout, wonderful, faithful Catholic who, you know, is not sleeping with your fiance, and I still hear, but we're still not ready to have children for a couple of years. And then I've told them, but then you're not ready to get married. That's actually what the union is for, like, it actually ordered towards then at the creation of a child. So they're missing the point, but I don't know if the document says anything about that.
I don't know. And I mean, just this kind of giving up on that, it's just hopeless to ask people. And, you know, this is something really has become a hallmark of this pontificate as exemplified in the apostolic exhortation Amoris Laetitiae, and was explicitly said there, is that the idea of all of the virtues, and especially marriage, being ideals that we will fall short of. And never has marriage ever, because I did a search, marriage has never been spoken about as an ideal, except when John Paul II, in Familiaris Consortio, brought it up to say, this is not how we should speak about marriage. Mm-hmm. And it was stated in previous documents that God provides the grace. When God asks us to do something, when he asks us to live up to his moral law, he provides the grace. We might fail. We might fall short, then need to go to confession, pull ourselves up, have the grace to remedy the situation, firm purpose of amendment, et cetera, et cetera. We may fall many times, but the church assures us that if we want to conform to God's will, he will give us the grace. And marriage is not this ideal that is unattainable. And chastity before marriage, as long as people don't put up huge roadblocks, is not an unattainable ideal. But it's so weird to think that in this document about the guidelines, they say there's this little phrase that was thrown out there. It is never useless to speak of the virtue of chastity. When you say it's never useless, you're kind of saying it's kind of useless.
Right. It's a throwaway line. Like, oh, okay. Well, but no. Yeah, we don't just throw away that line and, oh, well, no. It's wow. That's, yeah, it seems very jaded. I don't know. They've lost their hope or belief in the sacrament.
Well, now we have one more little comment that I want to throw out there, which is somebody said, a long engagement and lengthy preparation time does not fix an already shallow or rocky relationship, and it only burdens relationships that are faithful and solid. And I think that that is a very wise way to look about it, because just practically, what about if, I mean, I have two daughters who married military men. There were very short windows when they could get married. And what if somebody's in the military? What if a couple's older? Not every couple who want to get married are young. We are actually teetering on the brink of demographic implosion, because on average, our women in the Western world, in the U.S., are waiting until they're almost 30 to get married. You have them wait another year, that could be it. I mean, it's already dicey whether they you know, their fertility is going to be there.
I've seen that happen. I've seen that happen with friends. I mean, and when they were faced even, again, in this diocese with a 9-month wait, you know, I know a situation where someone was told, you can't even start the 9-month wait until the fiance moves in a few months from where he is to this diocese, then you can start the 9-month wait. And, you know, things like that can be so discouraging. And for an older couple, like you said, these women, they know their fertility window is, I know, again, women in their mid-30s now who haven't yet found anyone, and they know that, okay, so I still have to find someone, you know, and then once I find the guy, then we have to date a little while. And then after we date a little while, I'm going to have another year before we could, you know, after we get engaged to get married. And it's almost, you could almost sense the despair. Like it's dark. It's not, this isn't good. This isn't what the church should be offering. And like you said, I mean, I had a daughter also marry in the military. In that case, it was kind of nice to work through the Archdiocese of the military. That was at that point, I don't even know if they do it anymore, but they were helpful. You know, it was like, okay, they understood. Yeah. It's I have had people weep, weep and say, this isn't right. It's not fair. And it really isn't. And so if you go from an already one size fits all, you know, okay, 6 months or okay, 9 months, and now we're going to go to a year and everybody has to do this, you are asking people to, you're actually inviting them to go and get married outside the church. You know, especially if you have these women who rightly worry about their fertility if they wait and wait and wait through no fault of their own oftentimes. But, you know, if they have to make a choice, it's an unthinkable choice between having a child eventually or trying to have a child or waiting to get married in the church. People aren't that strong. I don't know why. I mean, I wish everybody was so strong that they would never commit a sin and never be tempted outside, you know, to marry outside the church. But we have to think about what part the church is playing with some arbitrary rules in tempting them to get married outside the church. Why do we want that? This is not a game. Sometimes I feel like, you know, is this a game? Like, you know, how long can you wait? Or can you jump through this hoop or that? And if not, well, why are we doing that to people when it's unnecessary? It is not necessary to do it. It's not required. It's never been done before in the history of the church. So why now?
Yes, that is a very good question. why now? And I do think that we have a situation of bureaucracy overtaking Christian life, and we really need to resist this. And so I'm going to work up to this. I'm going to quote again from another article about this new guideline. It says, by speaking of a marriage catechumenate, the dicastery said, it wanted to make clear that the goal is not simply to pass on church teaching about sexuality, marriage, and married life, although those are essential, but to help couples recognize and thrive in the mystery of sacramental grace, which belongs to them by virtue of the sacrament, to bring to life the presence of Christ with them and among them. But does one have the mystery of sacramental grace before marriage? Which I think the answer is no, you don't have it when you get married. And I actually think that many relationships blow up or fizzle out because the couple are dealing with all of the challenges of a relationship, which we all know that men and women, you know, there's love, but there's also a challenge of just getting along because they do not actually have the grace. I have heard of couples therapy for couples who aren't married, and I kind of feel like, what's the point? If you're not getting along, if there's a fundamental reason that you're not getting along, you need to find someone who you can get along with. However, you can wait to a point where the real therapy is that you need to get married, and have actually seen relationships that I think should have been more than salvageable, would have been really wonderful, but the problems overwhelmed the goodness precisely because they just did not have the sacramental grace.
Right.
So I bring up as an anecdote about that, just this fundamental misunderstanding of the grace of the sacrament, like that it happens at a particular time, namely at your wedding. And instead putting everything into programs which make it feel like you're doing something when really you just need to do this one thing, which is marry them.
Is that is that part of the therapy culture that we're in, which is everything has to be therapized? I mean, ad nauseum, everything is just, what about the fact that the vows are very simple? Like I always laugh because I'm like, you know, I got married 32 and a half years ago. And it took until I started doing my work on marriage 5 or 6 years ago to revisit the marriage vow. And I had like almost all but forgotten what the marriage vow is. And I wonder how much of what this is, you know, what we're proposing here is about looking at the very simple marriage vow. Like that's what you're going to be vowing to do. There's the promise. Let's look at it. It's not complicated. Again, not brain surgery. Whereas, you know, we're doing couples therapy and we're getting into our, you know, all these different tangents of a million different ways to look at the future. And it's like, well, what about, can we look at what we're vowing to do, you know, and then,
right.
And then at a certain point, you've got to make a decision. Just make a decision because like you said, once you make that decision and once that sacrament is confected, you've got the grace. You've got the grace to do it.
You have the grace. It's an objective reality, whereas the therapeutic aspect is completely subjective. Once you're married, you have the objective reality that you have entered into a sacramental relationship bound by vows. Then, yeah, do what it takes to work out the issues. And if beforehand you have these issues, I really feel that there's two paths open to you. And one is to say, this relationship is not great. I need to get out of it. Or the pressure that we're feeling and the reason that things are going bad is because really we should be married. I was once asked to read a book and promote it from a publisher, a Catholic publisher, written by Catholics. It was a book about marriage. And in this entire book, and I did a search of the PDF, the fact that marriage is a sacrament was not mentioned. Hmm. It simply was not mentioned, much less given a chapter. And of course, needless to say, I declined,
right?
But not without saying, listen, do you realize this? And the answer that I received was, oh, well, I mean, whatever. And it's kind of like, this book is worthless because the point is that marriage is a sacrament with sacramental grace, not just for that one day, but for the entire life of that couple. They will have sacramental grace. And I feel that this is something that we just need to truly question why it is that we go about things the way we do. And this is very fraught because everyone involved does have good intentions, but the intentions are being directed in a way that is not actually healthy. And it is the role of the authority and their duty, in this case of the hierarchy, to channel the good intentions, the bright ideas, and the energy, and to use prudence and to address some of this one aspect, which is that because we're making it all into a program and a long process, that it is actually becoming professionalized. And I went through some of the programs that are offered from various institutions of higher learning, and they all tend, I won't go through them all now, anyone, you can go and look them up yourself, but they're all offered, the higher degrees in theology and in ministry are very consciously offered to enable the person who is seeking them to work in the church. And when you have a professional class, you're going to have the necessity to justify what that person is offering and being paid for of producing content. And that content will always expand. And so it is not by any means any kind of surprise to me that the time is being lengthened and also the material is being increased. And that, frankly, that's a huge problem. Regardless of the intention, that is an example of the classic issue of rent seeking, which is creating a problem and then offering your services to solve the problem. And if the problem that's being created is everybody is being made to wait and being inundated with tons of information that they can't absorb because they don't actually have the formation that they need, well, then you come along with your services. Well, let's remedy that. Here's some more information. And pretty soon you just have this spiraling of, you know, time and effort, and it's really not necessary. The church needs to be making it easier to get married and have babies, not harder. Now, one glaring reason behind this whole issue of getting married and staying married, why it's harder in our time, is divorce. And you, Layla, have often talked about what you call the two exit ramps from marriage. And I really want you to discuss that for us and for our listeners.
Yes, this is near and dear to my heart because I have so many people of goodwill. I mean, good, wonderful Catholics who truly do believe, as I said before, that a better marriage prep is going to keep marriages together. Like, that is what's going to do it. We just have to improve our marriage prep. And I'm flabbergasted only because until and unless we close up the two greased exit ramps from marriage, which are no-fault divorce, which again, in this culture, the abandoning guilty spouse, the one who wants to break the contract, will 100% of the time get that result. They will be able to get out. No questions asked, basically. There is no chance that someone who wants a divorce doesn't get a divorce. in this culture, right? So no fault divorce. That is a greased exit ramp out of a marriage civilly. And I don't see that being fought against by the bishops, by the way. I do not hear anybody talk about the destruction of marriage via the laws of this land that, you know, are no fault divorce. Like that is one of the worst laws on the books. That's one of the worst things that we face as Catholics.
I can hear people saying no, but Layla, that's just the way it is.
Well, that's just the way it is with abortion being legal. It was just the way it was with slavery. It was just the way, when you take a natural law issue that is so foundational to society's functioning and you just let positive law come in and you just throw those truths and God's created order to the side. Because remember, part of God's created order is that marriage is permanent. Whether it's a sacramental marriage or a natural marriage, it is meant to be permanent because of the children, right? It's meant to be permanent. And we have silence on this issue. It swept through the land. It swept through, taking everyone with it. No marriage is safe. That's why anybody going into marriage today, I don't care how devout you think your spouse is, nobody is safe from the day that a spouse decides, I don't want to be here anymore and I'm suffering. It could be 5 years in, 10 years in, 20 years in, 50 years in. That person can leave off the first greased exit ramp, which is civil divorce. Boom, done, you're out, no fault. And then we have the reflexive annulment for the Catholics. And when I say reflexive, I mean, they're actually couples who are divorced, first of all, not only to even seek or go approach a tribunal, you are required in America to have a civil divorce. So basically the church is saying you must get divorced before we'll even look at your case as far as whether or not you had a valid marriage. So you have to go through this evil process, this divisive, horrid, I mean, any goodwill that was there before a civil divorce is gone by the time it's over. So by then you get to the tribunal. Well, when I say reflexive, I mean that even, again, people of goodwill, there is a, you know, there are workshops, you know, come and see what it's like to be able to come get your annulment. You know, we want to teach you how, we're going to help you every step of the way. Most people who get divorced who are Catholics are welcomed to go to the tribunal and please, you know, please let us see if we can find a way to quote unquote heal you and to get you kind of moving on healthily to the next step in your life. So you've got this reflexive annulment. And when I say that, and people always challenge me and they say, Layla, it's not easy. You know, gosh, it is not easy to get an annulment. Don't say that. It's very difficult. My point is not that it's not arduous and that you have to go through a lot of different emotional and structural things to get through a formal annulment. Obviously, there's two different types of annulments. We won't really get into that. But let's say a sacramental marriage, a couple who was married in the church. Yes, it's going to be arduous. It's going to be difficult perhaps to get through it. But when I say you'll reflexively kind of get it, generally speaking, the outcome is known. I mean, we kind of know this. Okay. There are very few people who are told, no, you don't, you know, your marriage is valid. Very few people. And even if you are told that, you can appeal that, you know, ad infinitum. You can even, I believe you could even go to different dioceses if you move, and there's ways. So basically anyone who wants out of a marriage will get out of a marriage. So you got these, we're making it harder on the front end to get married, which should be easier, and easy to get out on the back end. So until you close up those two greased exit ramps, I don't care what you do on the front end. You could make them wait 10 years and put them through, you know, psychotherapy programs. And I don't care what. The minute someone starts suffering in a marriage, they can escape. They can get out. Until you close that up. So we're not even looking at the back end. We're not even looking at how do we stop the hemorrhaging, you know, because everyone's going to suffer and it's going to be bad. Many marriages have extreme suffering, infidelity, addiction, abuse, you know, so much stuff, just general misery. But until you close up the exit ramps, I don't care what kind of marriage prep you're going to do. You could make it 10 years. You know, the year, I think, is obviously far too long. But it's just wrongheaded. So I feel bad. I'm always correcting my friends who think that, you know, we just need to get this marriage prep going and do it the right way. It's like, you don't understand. It's not going to do a thing. It's not going to do a thing. You're not going to see a difference.
Yeah. And the sort of imputation of the whole marriage prep process as being so pure and so helpful and so accompanying and so formative, and we're just gonna help them see the beauties of this, you know, wonderful journey that they're embarking on. But that is somewhat belied by the things that are said to the couple when they are in marriage prep. And we have some anecdotes that came up in our posts in Facebook. For instance, one person said, "We only met with our pastor once." This was in the context of describing a really arduous process that involved emailing long questions and long answers and long responses back and forth that took, you know, months and months of Sundays taking up the time of this couple. And it was with other couples. So this wasn't with the pastor at all. And like going into all of these, yeah, like quasi-therapeutic things that the whole time she was doing it, she was just saying, "I just have to do it to get married. I have to do this." She wasn't absorbing any of it. She wasn't benefiting from it. It was just, this is the mountain I have to climb. And then she said at the end, "We only met with our pastor once, and it was to complete the Freedom to Marry questionnaire," which is the canonical bit of paperwork that I was referring to at the beginning. And he candidly admitted some of the questions on it were asked in case one party sought an annulment later on. So yes, I mean, to a certain extent, you do have to, I mean, you can get an annulment if it turns out that the person coerced you, or you were actually brother and sister, which, by the way, has now become much more likely with in vitro fertilization. But leave that aside. That's a topic for another day. But certainly there is this kind of like judgment-proofing mentality of like put down certain things so that later you can get out of it. And that sounds frivolous. Like, Lila, how can you say that? Well, I have one couple who called me up just in really distraught after meeting with the priest in their marriage prep. I mean, it's a lovely, wonderful, faithful, totally innocent couple who said that the priest kind of, you know, as a quote unquote joke, said to them, "Oh, you know, and if you ever get divorced, don't worry, your paperwork is right here." Now, that's the kind of thing that it's all fun and games when the couple haven't gotten married yet. They're all starry-eyed. It's all a fairy tale. They're going to have their great wedding. It's going to be so beautiful. 10 years down the road, that's the kind of thing, a little shard that enters into your consciousness, and you're going to say, "Oh, remember when the priest said my paperwork is going to be there?" It's not even that you need to, like, you're going to know where the paperwork is. That's not the point. The point is that he opened that door in your consciousness. It's like saying to a woman who's pregnant, "Oh, your baby might die." Who would do that? Mm-hmm. You just don't say things.
Right.
And that is the kind of thing. And yeah, maybe they are jaded. Maybe they are, he was a pretty young priest. Maybe already he's kind of overwhelmed by the things he's confronting. But again, we're setting up a self-fulfilling prophecy here that is so destructive.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, between that, between the, you know, the putting in kind of the joking, yeah, well, you know, you'll get, you know, we all kind of know in the back of our heads, well, maybe my marriage is invalid and maybe I could get this annulment. And sometimes the priest jokes about it or whatever, you know, and then you have the other extreme, which is, you know, the idealization of what it will be like. And again, I love, like you said, the way that JP2 presents theology of the body, but a lot of people kind of make it into this, if you don't have this, if you don't have particular kind of sex life, if you don't feel this feeling, and if you don't mesh together perfectly in this way and feel like, you know, so transcendent every time and blah, 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 that's also a setup for failure, because you're not being told about the cross. You're not being told about suffering. You're being told, oh, I guess this wasn't the guy because it's not feeling like they said in the TOB classes, you know, so clearly I didn't marry the right guy. And, you know, that makes you more prone to divorce and find the one that clearly you didn't find the first time. And I mean, there's just a lot going on in all of this, where what we really need to stress is, look, it's a natural state. To get married is your right. And there will be heavy, heavy crosses. And when you have these heavy crosses, that's when you're going to lean on the grace of the sacrament. And that's when you're going to look back on your vow and you're going to say, what did I vow? What did I say before God and the community that I would do to death, to the end?
So do you think that if a couple were saying, this is just not working out, leaving aside certain particular situations, but let's just take the vast majority of the cases that we've heard of couples who, you know, really did carry their crosses, and then they said, well, maybe we could just end this marriage, get an annulment, we'll still be Catholic, there's a chance for us to have a different kind of life. Would you say that if the church insisted, come and talk to us right then, versus get your divorce and then come and talk to us, that there is a chance that could be turned around, even in these dire situations?
Absolutely. I've talked about this, and some of the people that I work with on these issues have talked about this. There needs to be like a marriage triage for every parish that has a divorce and separation ministry, which in many cases kind of is facilitating you kind of through the divorce and annulment process onto the next romance type thing, you know, to kind of move on from that first marriage. What if instead we had in those parishes a marriage triage, you know, where you would go to get the help that you needed? Because, you know, as you know, I followed up my divorce work with the redemption of impossible marriages, a bunch of stories, impossible marriages redeemed. Can these marriages be redeemed that just seem hopeless? Well, of course they can. Of course they can. You can't end the story in the middle, right? What does God have in store for us? Well, we won't know if we end the marriage in the middle of what his plan was, which was to go until one of the spouses dies. And, but we don't have that. We don't have that structure set up, because nobody's interested in doing it. If they are, I almost never hear about that as being something that's important to parish life.
Yeah. When I read Impossible Marriages Redeemed, the book that you put together, there were stories in there that I was like, oh yeah, they should definitely get divorced.
Right? Exactly. I mean, you know,
you're kind of like, oh, well, this is hopeless. Mm-hmm. And then when you realize, oh, mea culpa, no, they had the daring and the courage and the hope and the faith not to say what I just said. And sometimes because people stepped in, and sometimes because the Holy Spirit whispered to them, and sometimes maybe some unknown person was praying, but yeah, like it, yeah, it does seem that there has to be something besides accepting this terrible status quo of our society and then dumping other things on top of it.
We're now, you know, stopping people from getting married, and we really have programs facilitating getting them out of a marriage. Why are we doing it? That's the opposite of what it should be. It's an inverse. It's the inverse of what should be happening. And I don't understand why that's the focus, why we're doing it that way when it seems counterintuitive. I don't know. I think it's counterintuitive to keep the exits open and the entrance closed when we're trying to encourage marriage and family and babies. And so then the question is, are we trying to encourage that?
And interestingly, when we did, people say, well, that's unrealistic. Really? Because up until our time, in very difficult situations, if anybody thinks that the early church was a piece of cake, they're forgetting about the babies left on rocks to die. Catholics married very quickly and stayed married until they died. And was there suffering? Yes, there is always suffering. But I mean, overall, I think we could say that Catholics, I don't think that the quality of happiness, life, you know, the quality of satisfaction is super high among, you know, Catholics, and then therefore in the rest of society. I mean, people are scoring pretty low on their satisfaction scales. And I kind of feel like give it a chance, you know, give it a chance, because we say things are bad, but our remedies are not working and people are not actually really happy and we don't have babies. So it's kind of like, well, maybe we need to give the old ways a chance. And I think it's also just is so funny to just think about, like, this is just human nature to get married. And I have to quote this, I have to bring up this quote from The Quiet Man, which I love so much, which I think really kind of crystallizes the whole notion. It just said in a funny way, I love that movie, The Quiet Man, with Maureen O'Hara and John Wayne. It's one of my favorite movies. It's so funny, but it also just has a lot of wisdom in it. And of course, we have Sean Thornton, and he's trying to get Mary Kate to like him, and they're in the rain and they're in the graveyard, and he says to her, if anybody had told me 6 months ago that today I'd be in a graveyard in Innisfree with a girl like you that I'm just about to kiss, I'd have told them. Mary-Kate, oh, but the kisses are a long way off yet. Huh? Well, we just started courting, and next month we will start the walking out, and the month after that there'll be the thrashing parties, and the month after that, nope. Well, maybe we won't have to wait that month.
Yep.
Or for the threshing parties.
Nope.
Or for the walking out together.
No.
And so much the worse for you, Sean Thornton, for I feel the same way about it myself. And that scene to me is just like, yes, people just, they love each other. Let's encourage that. Let's help them. Let's make our own family is good and strong. Let's raise our children really well. Let's help our children raise their children well. Let's bring back the Ten Commandments. And let's let people get married and have babies. And we don't need the threshing parties. We just need to have good, solid Catholic life.
Amen. Amen to that, Lila.
Well, I really appreciate you coming and talking all of this over with me and bringing your wisdom and understanding and research to all of it. This has been really fun.
We did it. We finally did our Layla and Layla podcast, our Lila and Lila podcast. I feel like it's a momentous event, but I always learn from you. So I thank you. You're one of my mentors. So thank you.
Well, vice versa. We'll all raise each other up together as we discuss all these things. And so thank you very much again for spending the time, and we'll see you again, and we'll have to do this again. It was really delightful. Take care.
Thank you. God bless.
In the words of our patron, St. Thomas More, to his daughter, Margaret, farewell, my dear child, and pray for me, and I shall for you and all your friends, that we may merrily meet in heaven.
Thank you for joining us for this podcast. This is Phil Lawler speaking for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation, and I hope you'll register on our website to receive information about future events hosted by the center. If you find these recordings helpful, please help us to continue our work by making a tax-deductible contribution. We cannot continue to provide fine programming without the support of people like you, and we're grateful for your help. To receive updates on our activities or to make a contribution to our work, see our webpage at restorationchristianculture.org. That's all lowercase with no spaces or punctuation, restorationchristianculture.org. Thank you again.